Germany says it would welcome a resumption of NATO dialogue with Russia through a council that has not met for 2 years. Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says adopting political positions regarding the 2050 nuclear deal is counterproductive. And Beijing accuses the European Union of hypocrisy and double standards amid an escalating row over what the bloc calls the mistreatment of minorities in China's Xinjiang region. Thanks for joining us. The German foreign minister has called for resuming dialogue between the Western military alliance, NATO, and Russia. Heiko Maas was speaking on the sidelines of a meeting of foreign ministers from NATO member states in Brussels. The top German diplomat added that the ball is in Russia's court to resume talks with the alliance through a council that last met in July 2019. Ties between the West and Russia are at post-Cold War lows. This is rooted in issues ranging from disagreements over Ukraine and Syria crises to allegations of hacking U.S. elections. The U.S. is also trying to revitalize NATO after 4 years when the former administration of Donald Trump portrayed it as outdated, divided, and in crisis. Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says adopting political positions regarding the 2050 nuclear deal is counterproductive. Kazem Gharibabadi says using outdated allegations against Iran will not justify the agency's deliberate failure in addressing other proliferation issues, such as Israel's nuclear status. The Iranian official made the comment in reaction to a recent interview by the IAEA chief with Newsweek. Rafael Grossi had called for detailed and technical discussions regarding the presence of uranium particles at undeclared locations in Iran. Gharibabadi said such interviews can narrow the chances of success in the agency's future initiatives. Tehran and IAEA have reached a temporary deal for 3 months and will decide on further cooperation afterwards. Omelezghi says Iranian officials have time and again warned that political comments by the IAEA about the JCPOA create an atmosphere of confusion.
When Mr. Grossi, as the head of an international organization that's meant to be politically neutral and impartial, when he comes and makes political comments like saying that this is going to be a cloud that's going to cast a shadow on the issue of JCPOA negotiations, or that whether the issue of the safeguards related concerns of how are they going to affect the JCPOA, and this is just in the as far as Iran is concerned, creating an atmosphere of confusion, aggravating the situation, and it's just not, as far as Iran is concerned, the job of the agency to make political statements publicly when it's going to affect the situation.
The U.S. Special Rapporteur probing the assassination of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi says that she received death threats from the kingdom's officials last year. In our news review program, we discussed this issue with our guest. Let's take a listen.
On this news review, United Nations Special Rapporteur says a top Saudi official has issued a death threat against her for investigating the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Agnes Calamard said she was alerted by her colleagues that in January 2020, a senior Saudi official had twice threatened to have her taken care of. She said her colleagues perceived the message as a death threat. Calamard was the first official to publicly investigate and published a detailed report into the 2018 murder of Khashoggi. She published a 100-page report in June 2019, concluding that there was credible evidence the Saudi crown prince and other officials were liable for the killing. Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have international lawyer and political analyst Barry Grossman, who's joining us from Bali. Also, we have author and commentator John Stepling joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Grossman in Bali. Sir, give us your thoughts on the recent remarks coming from the UN's Agnes Callamard?
Well, look, on the plus side, I have no doubt that the bail threat was made. The problem is, of course, the words used to make the threat can be taken to mean almost anything, and certainly don't meet any kind of a criminal standard in holding anyone responsible, even if there was the political will to do something about it. I also have no problem with the report which she was responsible for authoring, the 100-page report issued in 2019 by the UN, and the terms adopted in that report for essentially saying, if nothing else, that the government of Saudi Arabia was responsible for the killing of Khashoggi, and that in all likelihood MBS knew about it. And of course, more recently, President Biden has arguably gone even further and said not only that MBS knew about it, but approved of it. The problem is the timing of this story breaking strikes me as a little bit odd now that Ms. Callamard is due to take up. Remember, these threats were made over a year ago, and she's now due to start her position as the head of Amnesty International. Suddenly, this story is breaking, which strikes me as being a bit opportune, and I question what's really going on in this story breaking now. Finally, I would point out that the action that she called for in her report, namely that appropriate investigations be undertaken either by the Human Rights Council at the UN or the Security Council or even the Secretary General's office, have not been acted upon. And certainly the ICJ has not taken any issue with this, and there hasn't been a case referred to the ICJ by, for example, Turkey, who you would have expected to have some kind of an interest in seeing justice be done. After all the original noise, Turkey went very quiet, and we can only speculate about what lies behind that. So all in all, I see this as a bit of a storm in a teacup. To be fair to her, the report certainly rings true. The claim that she was, in very loose terms, threatened rings true, but that was over a year ago. And being something of a cynic, I think the story breaking now has far more to do with her starting up her position of the largely neocon infiltrated Amnesty International.
Mr. Sepling, what are your thoughts on the issue? Do you agree with our guest, Mr. Grossman, in Bali?
Yeah, I largely agree with everything he just said. I mean, the timing is extraordinarily curious, and there's no reason given for this delay in her claims, making public her claims. The Khashoggi assassination was particularly gruesome. The Tiger Squad, so-called, Bin Salman's select group of killers, travel through airports with forensic tools and chains, bone saws rather, and it's all very kind of lurid and gangster-like. But Bin Salman is a very reckless and impulsive leader, and things have not been going his way for the last couple of years. I mean, they haven't gone his way since he took power in 2017. His vision 2030 has been a catastrophe, the aggression against Yemen, a global embarrassment, and has turned public opinion against the monarchy even more than it had been before. So then we see this journalist, who is a kind of centrist establishment voice. I mean, Amnesty International is a deeply compromised institution, frankly, and is heavily influenced by the think tanks in Washington, the Brookings and so forth, Cato, whatever, all of those, and so it is a voice for the status quo. What the intention of these comments are is a bit of a mystery to me, but the Saudis are given a free pass. They are always given a free pass. They are a huge purchaser of weapons. They work closely, Saudi intelligence, with U.S. intelligence in the region. The target is always Iran, who is seen as a embarrassment to the United States policies, an impediment to their goals in Syria, removing Assad and so forth. So the Saudis are often an embarrassment to the U.S., but they don't really care. It may be, I've said before, that it may be, and bin Salman himself may be, you know, the avatar for this, that the Saudis have outlived their usefulness. Regime change in Saudi Arabia is not an impossibility. What form that would take, I don't know. But there were rumblings. Lindsey Graham several years ago floated that idea, as I recall. So we'll see what happens. But in the bigger picture, this is a bit of perception management for Ms. Calamard and free press for Amnesty International, and doesn't really amount to much.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. We're going to have to leave it there. Barry Rossman, international lawyer and political analyst, joining us from Bali. Also, thanks to author and commentator John Stepling, joining us from Indore, Norway. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review.
Welcome back. The Taliban militant group has rejected an early presidential election proposal that the Afghan President Ashraf Ghani is reportedly set to unveil next month. The Taliban say that they will not support Ghani's proposal, calling the elections a scandalous process. The group says such a decision should be made in talks between the two sides. Two government officials said on Tuesday that President Ghani will announce the election plan at a conference in Turkey next month. According to the officials, the election will be held within 6 months. Ghani's effort is seen as a counteroffer to a U.S. proposal for the formation of an interim government involving the Taliban before American troops leave the country by May 1st. Our correspondent in Kabul, Amin Alami, says Taliban's rejection of snap elections in Afghanistan comes as no surprise.
It was expected that the Taliban will reject such a proposal offered by President Ghani in order to hold an early election to bring stability to Afghanistan, because analysts and many influential political leaders here in Afghanistan believe that focusing on holding an election will not meet the needs of the Taliban militant group. That is why they are rejecting such a proposal by the Afghan government, and this is considered as only one of many cases behind such policy of the Taliban militant group. In the meantime, many others here say that given the Taliban is also after forming an interim government that will pave the way for the militant group to have many of its key figures on the key positions of this new and interim government, the militant group is after backing such idea that is also being supported by many other countries, including Russia and the United States.
Beijing condemns the summoning of the Chinese ambassador by the European Union over the alleged ill-treatment of the country's Muslim Uyghurs, warning that China will not be blackmailed.
Based on lies and false information, the European Union used the so-called human rights issue in Xinjiang as an excuse to impose sanctions on Chinese entities and individuals. The EU only allows itself to arbitrarily smear and attack others and even arbitrarily impose sanctions based on false information and lies, but does not allow the Chinese to talk back or fight back. This in itself is double standards, a manifestation of bullying, overbearing behavior, and hypocrisy.
China's foreign ministry spokeswoman also condemned the EU for blacklisting four former and current officials in the Xinjiang region. Beijing also summoned the bloc's ambassador to protest the sanctions. Western rights groups have accused China of ill-treatment of mostly Muslim minorities in camps in Xinjiang, saying that they are subjected to forced labor. China has strongly denied the allegations, saying that training programs, work schemes, and better education have been provided in the camps. Many countries across Europe continue to see a steep rise in COVID infections and deaths, despite vaccination programs and restrictions to curb the spread of the disease. Poland has reported 575 more deaths, the highest this year. Bulgaria, nearly 5,000 new cases, its highest daily tally on record. Meanwhile, Ukraine reported a new daily high of 342 deaths, registered over 1.5 million infections and more than 30,000 deaths so far. Germany reported some 16,000 new infections and nearly 250 fatalities in the last 24 hours. Despite the country's battle with the third wave, the German chancellor said that her government is ditching pandemic measures amid the public backlash.
I have decided to give this last-minute news conference because I decided this morning not to move forward with the necessary regulations to enable the extra quiet time agreed on Monday, i.e., the extra quiet days on Thursday and Saturday. I have decided to abort this move.
She made the remarks after an emergency crisis meeting to mitigate recent criticism over extending the lockdown measures. Last week, thousands of Germans hit the streets to protest against prolonging COVID-related restrictions. That despite the country's health authorities had warned that coronavirus infections were increasing exponentially. The European Union has tightened export curbs on COVID-19 vaccines to prevent what it calls an unfair one-way flow of vaccines out of the bloc. The VP of the European Commission said member states adopted two adjustments to the existing mechanism. According to Valdis Dombrovskis, the new measures could limit vaccine exports to countries like Britain, which refuse to export their own vaccines to the bloc. EU officials also say the regulation is aimed at making vaccine trade reciprocal and proportional. The move comes 1 week after European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen complained that the bloc had exported more than 10 million doses to the UK, but received no vaccine consignments in return.
Legislators from across the EU's 27 countries say citizens' patience has run out as hundreds of millions wait to be called for a COVID-19 vaccine. AstraZeneca is to deliver 170 million fewer doses than promised during the next 3 months.
It's absolutely shame. We have to be absolutely clear and stop it. Stop it. With AstraZeneca, with these dirty tricks, we cannot accept it.
The Director General of the European Commission's Health Division, Sandra Galina, moved to shift any blame from her institution during the debate in the European Parliament, Brussels.
This bad performance of AstraZeneca has created a reputational issue for all of us, be it the Commission or the Member States.
But lawmakers say the European Commission waited too long to sign contracts with vaccine producers. The debate was told less than 5% of the EU's population have received the required two jabs of approved vaccines. The bloc citizens are taking note, according to experts.
Huge popular waves of Euroscepticism, lack of trust in national institutions, European institutions, in leaders.
Russia's highly effective vaccine, Sputnik V, was the first in the world to be approved for mass use. However, the EU appears to have snubbed it.
Do you agree the approval process should be based on efficacy and safety in terms of health outcomes and not geopolitics?
Lawmakers have been quizzing the European Medicines Agency about slow vaccine approvals. The US and UK inoculation programmes are making the EU look like a joke, it was suggested.
We have been using a more stringent approach and rigorous approach than the emergency use authorizations that a number of other countries have done.
Critics say the EU's threat to ban vaccine exports to Britain is petty and a sign of desperation. A third wave of coronavirus is taking hold in several EU countries, forcing businesses to remain closed. Lawmakers claim populist parties across the bloc are waiting in the wings to take advantage of the health, social and economic crises.
They argue that if the EU falls apart as a result, the powers that be will only have themselves to blame. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that is for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
During the first 2.5 months of coronavirus vaccine distribution within the U.S., counties with higher levels of poverty and other indicators of socioeconomic vulnerability were inoculated at lower rates, a new analysis shows. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Kenny Stansil Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Poverty, a Key Driver in Vaccine Inequities. CDC report shows. Here's more. During the first 2.5 months of coronavirus vaccine distribution within the U.S., counties with higher levels of poverty and other indicators of socioeconomic vulnerability were inoculated at lower rates, a new analysis shows. The report, published recently by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention CDC, compares county-level estimates of first-dose vaccination coverage. The percentage of people in a county who had received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine between mid-December and early March, with county-level measures of social vulnerability. According to the study, COVID-19 vaccination coverage was lower in high-vulnerability counties than in low-vulnerability counties, a finding largely driven by socioeconomic disparities. Comprised of 15 metrics that are categorized into four themes, the CDC's Social Vulnerability Index, SVI, combines census data on key socioeconomic and demographic variables, including income, educational attainment, household composition in terms of age and disability, prevalence of marginalized racial and linguistic groups, and housing and transportation characteristics, in an effort to minimize suffering during disasters by improving communities' preparation for and responses to hazardous events, including epidemics. Last year, the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine recommended that the Department of Health and Human Services and state, tribal, local, and territorial governments use the SVI as a tool to ensure the equitable allocation of COVID-19 vaccines. Nationally, a total of 51,873,700 residents of 49 states and D.C. received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine between December 14 and March 1st, a coverage rate of 15.1%. The study found that vaccination coverage was higher in low-vulnerability counties than in high-vulnerability counties, although a few states had more equitable coverage and patterns varied further when indicators were disaggregated. For the overall SVI measure, there was a vaccination coverage gap of 1.9 percentage points between low-vulnerability counties, that is about 15.8%, and high-vulnerability counties, that is about 13.9%. While the general pattern of unequal inoculation rates was found across three of four SVI themes, some factors were associated with greater disparities. The most pronounced vaccine inequalities, for instance, corresponded with socioeconomic status, which yielded a gap of 2.5 percentage points between low vulnerability counties and high vulnerability counties. Among socioeconomic status indicators, the most impactful variable was the percentage of adults without a high school diploma, which was associated with a difference of 2.8 percentage points between low and high vulnerability counties. Meanwhile, for three indicators, population aged 65 and older, multi-unit housing and households without a vehicle, vaccination coverage was slightly higher in high vulnerability counties, while higher coverage in counties with large proportions of older adults was consistent with the prioritization of this age group early in the vaccination program. The researchers wrote, "The higher coverage in counties with lower percentages of households with a vehicle available was unexpected and warrants further investigation." With respect to two indicators, percentages of people with disabilities and individuals who speak English less than well, inoculation rates were roughly the same in low and high vulnerability counties, a finding the researchers described as encouraging in light of the disproportionate incidence of COVID-19 in these populations. Regarding the remaining 10 indicators, however, vaccination coverage was higher in low vulnerability counties, demonstrating that equity in access to COVID-19 vaccination has not been achieved nationwide, as the report's authors put it. For the overall SVI measure, vaccine inequities were found in 31 states, including 11 where disparities were identified in all four themes. Additional efforts are needed to achieve equity in vaccination coverage for those who have been most affected by COVID-19, wrote the authors of the report. Improving COVID-19 vaccination coverage in communities with high proportions of racial, ethnic minority groups and persons who are economically and socially marginalized is critical, they added, because these populations have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19-related morbidity and mortality. According to researchers, monitoring community-level metrics is essential to informing tailored local vaccine delivery efforts, which might reduce inequities. Public health officials can investigate whether disparities are occurring because of access problems, that is, vaccine supply, vaccination clinic availability, and lack of prioritization of vulnerable groups, or other challenges such as vaccine hesitancy, they wrote. Vaccination promotion, outreach, and administration might focus on high vulnerability populations within counties, that is, providing resources to federally qualified health centers when socioeconomic disparities are identified. Three additional states had higher vaccination coverage in high vulnerability counties than in low vulnerability counties for the overall SVI measure and in three of four themes. Alaska fell short in socioeconomic status theme, while Minnesota and West Virginia had shortcomings in the racial minority and language theme. According to the report, practices in states with more equitable vaccination coverage included prioritizing persons in racial ethnic minority groups during the early stages of the vaccine program implementation, actively monitoring and addressing barriers to vaccination in vulnerable communities, directing vaccines to vulnerable communities, offering free transportation to vaccination sites, and collaborating with community partners, tribal health organizations, and the Indian Health Service. After acknowledging the study's limitations, including state-level variations in prioritizing policies, a lack of individual-level vulnerability data, and the existence of intra-county inequalities, among others, the authors concluded with a recommendation. As vaccine supply increases and the administration expands to additional priority groups, the researchers wrote, CDC, state, and local jurisdictions should continue to monitor vaccination levels by SVI metrics to aid in the development of community efforts to improve vaccination access, outreach, and administration among populations most affected by COVID-19. Inside Israel.
The social crisis in Israel has become big, so big that it's now a national security threat. This is according to the annual strategic assessment of Israel, published by the National Security Research Institute at Tel Aviv University.
Well, we're coordinating with the leaders of the different cities, and we're making sure that we're in close contact. But, of course, we know there is a lot of tension due to the recent cabinet decisions, and a lot of people, especially in the religious cities such as, for example, Bnei Brak. As we saw yesterday, there were protests, and there are possibly protests that might take place also this evening. So that is something that we're definitely ready to deal with if necessary. But, of course, the main aim will be to implement a full closure in all of the red zones, red cities.
The internal crisis in Israel now tops the third top post in the short list of national security threats facing Israel for the first time ever. In fact, it made the top list as the third most haunting issue for Israel, with Iran being on top place. This is the first time in Israel's history, apparently, that the social crisis there has been considered such a threat by the regime. It seems that things are only about to get worse there, too. According to the Institute, the internal crisis is represented by the instability of governance. The move to the fourth elections within 2 years would undermine the broad foundations of national security, the report added. The report also says that the crisis is a threat to Israel's national immunity. The report specifically cites the ongoing protests and the rise of violence, an increase in bipartisan and divisions in Israeli politics that has reflected in society. The crisis, the report warns, will also lead to a weakening of regime agencies and institutions through difficulties in performance and obstruction of decision-making procedures. There is also a significant decrease in public confidence in institutions and the absence of solidarity and a common goal among the segments of Israeli society. The Institute believed that society is torn between health, economic, social, political, and governance crises simultaneously revealed during the corona epidemic. Keyword here, revealed. It turns out that these issues have always lingered in Israel, but were never addressed. The current crisis comes in light of the spread of the coronavirus as a result of the population's non-compliance with the instructions of the Ministry of Health and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It also comes after some officials failed to adhere to instructions such as total closure on the population. And when officials did finally adhere to the regime's rules, health officials said it was too late.
The decline in trust in institutions has two reasons. One is a long-range effect, and one is the short-term, which relates to the corona. The long-term is the attack on institutions. mainly by Netanyahu over the last few years. The courts, the attorney general, the police, etc. The people who work, the civil servants who work at the Ministry of Finance. So the gatekeepers. I mean, if you attack these people and these attacks, look what happened in America with Trump attacking the media. Everybody is leftist. Everybody is subversive. So you can see the results in the decline of trust. And in the short term, relates to the corona. The management of the corona crisis is pretty poor. Just look at so many people, both on the ultra-Orthodox communities and the Arab communities, who just defy the orders of the government. So all in all, the long term and the short term have a strong impact on the decline of trust in institutions. I think the statement by the INSS that the internal divisions and feuds are a national security and actually a national crisis is correct. We can deal with any external threat, and we've shown over the decades that whenever we are attacked, we get together and we prevail. If we are divided like this and we lose trust in the institutions, and we are getting into the fourth elections in 2 years, no wonder people lose trust. And when they lose trust, this is very dangerous. So I agree, this is a great, great danger to Israel, the internal crisis, the internal feud. First of all, there's the old division between secular Jews or non-Orthodox Jews and Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel. This has a long history of there's a community that pay less taxes, they don't study the core issues like math and English, etc., which are necessary to modern world. Many of the men don't work, and they don't serve in the army like all of us. I served, my children served, and my granddaughter now is in the army. So to look at a community that doesn't take part in the national effort is very infuriating. Come the corona, and you see these people defying the orders of the Minister of Health, and they are getting infected. I think the Israelis would have accepted anything if they had leadership who would tell them, you know what, everybody has now to pay something. People who can, people who make a lot of money should have paid, should have been taxed to help others survive this. But you need leadership for this.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. On Twitter, Shimon says, an economic and social crisis in Israel. No services for welfare for 2 weeks. Leo says, Israel starting war to cover the economic and social crisis in Israel. Thousands of Israelis renewed weekly demonstrations against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, calling for the long-serving Prime Minister to resign over corruption charges against him and his alleged mishandling of the coronavirus crisis.
Israeli public, it has no belief in its officials, in its government, in all the government offices. There's no belief in them, in non-belief. The police's enforce is using extra power on children, on elderly, on just people that are in the streets, on one hand, and on the other hand, other people do whatever they want. Nobody believes anybody anymore. So people don't trust anybody. They don't trust the opposition, they don't trust the government. And the thing is, why the people went down to the streets is because the disbelief. And what a lot of, not all of them, but a lot of people are saying, we do not want to go back to, it's in Hebrew, it's called the old good state of Israel. We do not want to go there because it wasn't good for a lot of us. It wasn't good for the Palestinians, it wasn't good for the Mizrahim, it wasn't good for the Ethiopians, it wasn't good for a lot of people, basically. It wasn't good for the poor. So basically, I think people are saying, we want something that is completely new. We don't trust any of the politicians that are changing parties from, you know, they've been in this party and now they want to go in this party and now they're separating and they're combining. Most of the public does not believe the public figures in Israel almost anymore. There's no trust.
The effects of the political and economic crises and the strength of their negative effects largely stem from the way they were managed. Israelis blame the regime for the mismanagement of the coronavirus crisis. Opinion polls have recently showed the existence of a loss of confidence in the regime, Israel's leaders, and institutions. This loss of confidence has negatively affected the Israeli population's readiness to implement anything the regime tells it. Businesses, including restaurants, have failed to adhere lockdown procedures. The poll also shows that most Israelis support the continuation of the demonstrations and protests. This even in the backdrop of their deteriorating economic and social conditions. This is, of course, a huge threat to the Israeli regime. The demands of the protesters have begun with the downfall of Netanyahu, but these protesters have went on to ask for the dissolution of the cabinet and Knesset and a fourth election. In December, their demands are met. Now, with a fourth election set for March, the weekly anti-regime protests still continue with more people joining. A recent survey by the Israel Democracy Institute showed that 83% of Israelis believe that there is no social solidarity there. According to this poll, 74% of Israelis say that they do not trust parliament, that is the Knesset, and cannot rely on it in the face of the pandemic. 70% do not trust the cabinet, 63% of them do not trust finance ministry officials, 51% of them do not trust the police, and 47% do not trust the Ministry of Health.
A statesman is not a politician. A statesman thinks about the future of the country and what's good for the country. The politician thinks about the next election and what's good for him. And what we see today, we have politicians. We don't have the statesmen. We don't have the people who give us a vision. Just think about the Israelis today, they don't have hope. There's nobody they believe in who can speak to them and tell them the truth. If it's hard, Israelis know to go through hardships, but they need leaders, statesmen, to believe in. And we don't have these people right now. So let's see what happens in the next elections. I believe, I look at the protest, the hundreds of thousands of Israel taken to the streets, and there are some people who are doing it for week after week, you know, in the cold weather, rain or shine. And I know many of the young people who go to the process, and I see a lot of potential there. So, and also I'm a sworn optimist, so I believe that we will see a new generation of people emerging out of this crisis and taking over. I think Israeli want a direction. Israelis are willing to go through a lot of hardships, but show us where we are going. If you look at the, for example, the handling of the current corona crisis, the businesses are closing down. People are laid off. I don't know if they when the corona goes away, they will find any job anymore. And in the meantime, our leaders throwing money like from the helicopter on everybody, people who need it, people who don't need it, with no any plan of how we make a crisis into an opportunity. For example, strengthen the public health system. The reason why we survived this crisis is because we have Kupot Cholim, we have the public health organization, which are so strong and so accessible to the public. Look at the vaccination, how well it goes, because we have all those organizations which have been shrinking over the years because of lack of funds. And suddenly we have so much money to throw on everybody instead of investing in the public health system.
On social media, the conversation took a different turn. Sir Distick on Twitter says the commission found reasonable grounds to believe that individual members of the Israeli security forces, in the course of their response to the demonstrations, killed and injured civilians who were neither directly participating in hostilities nor posing an imminent threat. Yehi asks, what about the demonstrations against Bibi, the ones going on for months all through this pandemic? Jankowski says thousands of Israelis renewed their weekly demonstrations in occupied Jerusalem al-Quds against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, asking him to step down as Tel Aviv went into third COVID-19 lockdown. Since last year, Israel has been witnessing demonstrations everywhere.
It's a mistake to think that the public was out in the streets only to demand that the government will be dispersed. And it was a mistake, and there's also a mistake, a lot of people think that the demand is to interrogate all kinds of things, like the selling of the submarines or the buying of the submarines also to Egypt or to whoever. I'm not too involved in that issue. I think a lot of the public, some of the public is out there saying we want a government that is not corrupt. But a lot of people are out in the streets, or a lot of people are not out in the streets, but basically they feel that they do not want to go back to business as usual. They do not want any government. And also there's something I didn't mention, because on the last elections, one of the Kahol Levan party received a lot of voices. They received a lot of people voted for them, and the hope was that they would send Netanyahu to trial or to, you know, or home, basically. And they sold the public. They went in to coalition with the Netanyahu government. So people don't trust anybody. They don't trust the opposition. They trust the government. The people feel that the vaccinations, a lot of people are happy to take them, but a lot of people feel that the vaccinations, the fact that Israel is, has been receiving so many vaccinations, people feel that Israel is like, is the government is allowing people to be, the companies to do experiments on people here in Israel. So basically, the sense of disbelief is tremendous all over. And actually, when you look at the what's happening around in Israel, you see the Palestinians for 48, talking Umm al-Fahim and cities within Israel. They're actually, it's an uprise now. They're in the streets, there's police, they're children of 14 years old are being arrested violently. You have these collisions with the Nebak, with the Orthodox cities. You have it almost everywhere. Israel is extremely in unrest all around. There's nothing, you know, we've been out in the streets for 30 weeks now in Balfour in Jerusalem, but not only there. So basically, there's a big the society is in a situation of unrest. And also people feel that the fact that they were going to elections in the fourth time in 2 years, it's the feeling that there's no government. There's no head of police, there's all kinds of positions that are not occupied because the government, Netanyahu, is not, the government isn't functioning.
Israel has lost control of coronavirus for several reasons, the annual strategic assessment of Israel said. The most important of which is the loss of internal political stability and the failure of the Israelis to respond to the instructions of their regime. To this day, much of the Israeli public believes the coronavirus is a natural disaster, mainly due to their distrust of the regime. But it is important to note that these issues only shed light on underlying crises that have been ignored. Now, the social problem is a national and strategic security threat for Israel, one that has shaken the highest echelons of the regime.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.